From the heartland, deep in the Ouachita Mountains of western Arkansas, where the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, the Guerrilla Media Network presents The Reynolds Reveal, the new weekly show that, no matter the limitations that may trammel inquiry elsewhere, sifts and winnows without fear or favor. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and today is Tuesday, June 18th. 2013. This is episode number 18 of The Reynolds Reveal. I appreciate you for listening in, and therefore, hey, you like it or not, you're part of the show. And yes, we do welcome your calls here at the Guerrilla Media Network. The number, 218-862-9829, and that number will be repeated now and again during the show. My special guest on last week's show was Veronica Chapman of the United Kingdom, retired software engineer, who said she knew too much to remain employed in the industry. At least that's what interviewers told her. And despite a few technical glitches on last week's show, she was able to offer a sharp insight into the 9/11 fraud, the source of so much evil in the world, as well as a unique analysis of the law, by which she means the common law, the consensus law, the bottom-up law, the just, honorable way to do things, judge-discovered law. That's common law. And I said it was a gift from the English people, but she said, hey, it's just common sense. True, I'd say we're both right. Versus legalese, most of which is statute or legislation, and I, as an economist, of course, label most of that as special interest interventions. And she also gave us some insight into the global elite and mass mind control. And you can find her book, Freedom is More Than Just a Seven-Letter Word, and some of her other writings at info.fmotl.com. which stands for, or an acronym for, Free Man on the Land. And I want to turn to my special guest today a little earlier than I normally do, because I think it's so important and there's so much to cover here. And that guest is Eric Larson, with an S-E-N at the end. He is a professor emeritus at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. I like that criminal justice aspect, at the City University, New York. And he is a veteran of some 45 years of teaching English lit and composition. He's written and published widely for many years. He's author of two novels, An American Memory, 1988, and I Am Zo Henke, 1994. And of two nonfiction books, A Nation Gone Blind, that in 2006. Two more. He's got three nonfiction. Homer for Real, A Reading of the Iliad. Well, he's going to straighten this out for me. Any errors I make, Eric Larson will be able to straighten me out. That was in 2009. And he is founder and publisher of the Oliver Arts and Open Press. Two more items I want to mention about Eric Larson. I first met his work, encountered it in the foreword to Where Did the Towers Go?, the most important book, we agree, of the 21st century, and by Dr. Judy Wood. And let's see, he's founder and publisher of the Oliver Arts and Open Press. Eric, so much. You're so welcome to the Reynolds Reveal.
What a wonderful thing to hear, Morgan. Thank you so much.
It's great to have you, and I'm so impressed with your work. Well, I even dropped my monologue, my 18 minutes.
Oh, dear.
a sign of respect, and it's a privilege to speak to you. And what I was so impressed with, it's not just content, it's your felicity of expression.
Thank you.
I fancy myself a writer, and I think I passed the truth test. which is so key to serious writing. And I spent most of the day reading the Skull of Yorick to dig deeper into your work. And so that's going to be a big part of this. But I think the first thing I wanted to ask you was, tell us about your learning of Dr. Wood's work and that whole relationship, and in how or if you aided the book finally finding daylight.
Yes, well, my relationship with 9/11 is a somewhat embarrassing one, in a sense. I fell for the whole thing, hook, line, and sinker. That's what I fell for it, and I swallowed it on the day itself. I forgot. All was washed out of me. All of my 8th grade science, my high school physics, simply went away.
But now, Eric, where were you on that morning? Did you have any personal visibility or experience of the attacks on the World Trade Center?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Our younger daughter at that time was living in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. And, of course, they were 2 hours off from our time zone. And so at about 10 in the morning, I got a phone call. And it was from Gav. She was from Alberta. And she said, "Dad, I just woke up and I heard that an airplane hit the World Trade Center." Well, I hadn't heard a peep. But she woke up with her clock radio, and the clock radio was set to the news, and that's what the first thing she heard when she woke up. So I said, "Well, that can't possibly be Gav. I mean, I would hear sirens and all kinds of activity. Let me turn on WINS, Winds News, all news all the time." And sure enough, that was their top of the moment, or piece. So I told Gav, "Yes, apparently so. Let me talk with her later." So I actually, I ran out into Riverside Park. We're not far from Riverside Park, but I'm up in the high 90s on the Manhattan grid. And even out on the water's edge, I couldn't see anything down in that part of town. However, had I been down at 68th Street, where a very attractive pedestrian and fishing pier has been built, sticking out into the Hudson, I could have, from there, easily seen the World Trade Center structures. But I couldn't get down there fast enough. And I went home, and by this time, I remember meeting a couple guys coming up from playing tennis.
So what time of the morning was this?
It's 10, right after.
Okay.
But I heard, I knew by that time that there had been the second tower had been also hit. And because I told these two tennis playing guys. Came back home, and I saw the disappearance of the buildings on television.
So you saw a live broadcast of the two turning to dust.
Dust.
Yeah.
And my older daughter was in New York at that time. She's a photographer, and she a friend of hers had arranged a shooting in the house, in our apartment. And they didn't come off. People didn't arrive. But he was here. And I said, the television set was down in the bedroom. I was down there, and I had it on, and I saw the first disintegration. And I hollered out, "Run!" Oh, that was my telephone. I better let it go. Is that going to be on there?
Hey, what timing that first ring was. Run!
Yeah, there you are. It's from Calgary, Alberta. I can't make it get quiet, I guess. Oh, here we go. Okay. There's such a curse, aren't they, sometimes? Don't know what to do.
Modern technology. We got too much of it, huh?
Too much of it, yeah. But so I hollered down the house, down the hall, into the front of our apartment, and said, "Ron, you've got to see this." And I knew that it was something entirely overwhelming and momentous, but spectacular to the eye in a way that, of course, I'd never seen before. I didn't have anything like the astuteness of Dr. Judy Wood to realize that she was looking at something that did not follow the laws of physics as she had known them up to that point. But rather, I forgot, as I said, 8th grade science, 9th grade chemistry, physics, the whole thing washed right out of my head. And I couldn't imagine what was happening. And then, of course, the second time around, and then WTC-7 later in the day. The rest of my wife, however, saw it with her own eyes. She was down in Abingdon Square on her way to work. She'd stopped to treat herself to a French croissant in a little outdoor Cafe. Real near Christopher Street. And a couple of cops are sitting there having coffee, and the waitress came out and said, "You guys aren't going to believe this. Somebody says an airplane hit the Trade Center, or one of the Trade Center towers." The cops said, "Well, hey, we got to see this too." So everybody walked over to 6th Avenue and looked out in time to experience the receipt of the hole of the second building. The second building in its hole. Of course, its hole was on the far side of the building from where they were looking. So,
she was, let's say, half a mile north of the WTC complex or
so,
something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at least a half mile, maybe a little more. Uh-huh. Yep. And I've run into lots of, I've basically lost friends. I have a very good friend, indeed, whose marriage failed because of 9/11.
Oh, really? Expand on that. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, it's a dear, dear friend whom I met actually after the publication of A Nation Gone Blind. He found and read the book and got in touch with me, and we've been corresponding ever since. In fact, we've even met and had a drink together.
That was published in
06. Yeah.
Yes.
And he saw through so much so soon, and was so appalled, and he could not talk about it. His wife, on the other hand, very much like other wives whom I've known very, very closely, such as I may say, I don't know how far I should go with this verbiage right now, but otherwise, like mine, don't want to hear. And the pressure on him and from within himself to say, to talk, to let her tell her, was so strong, and her absolute adamant will not to hear was so strong that the marriage broke, specifically broke apart irreconcilably. Yeah, and I've lost friends. I've become suspect in the eyes of others who, people with whom I talked for 35 years. I think they won't. I'm sort of tongue-tied here because these are emotional issues, but also there is, and again, I used the word a moment ago, but an adamant unwillingness to hear. Now,
okay, I've got to bring this up because, of course, I have had, and other people who are 9/11 researchers or activists have had difficulties in their families. And the irony is that my second wife's side of the family has been nothing but supportive, and we'll call it my real family rather than my married into family has been far less. Okay, let it go at that. But here's a couple of things one thing that I've seemed to be onto lately, and that is it's not just this belief in American exceptionalism, and there have been criminal governments elsewhere in the world and in history, but oh my, it hasn't happened here and never will. Yeah. In other words, that kind of indoctrination nonsense. But rather, this is a pretty powerful argument that I wanted to see if you've thought about or inquired about, and that is, at the top, it seems like we are ruled by psychopaths. Now, in other words, people, as one aspect of it, a vital aspect, is they lack empathy. And it's like one of these psychologists that Veronica quoted, that one in four babies is born a psychopath without a conscience. And I don't know how exaggerated that is. And she even quotes this researcher as saying, "Well, it's a single gene deficiency," which I have not investigated this, but that sounds far fetched. But in any case, George W. Bush, he's clearly a psychopath. He does not have some of them are smart, as Veronica points out. They are not axe murderers. They don't kind of resort to the simplest kind of outrage, but rather they emulate what's around them, and they get to the, and some of them are, of course, interbred and all that. So what's your response to that idea?
My response is that it seems to me absolutely the case. It's just not irrefutably the case. I'm gonna mention something by way of supporting my remark, and I don't mean to get off the track, and I don't want us to, and it's not off the track, but it does introduce a new threat. There is a man on the West Coast in Portland, Oregon, named Paul Levy, and he has studied widely in Eastern and Eastern religions, Buddhism, Hinduism. And he has studied widely and deeply in Jung and in Freud, but mainly more so in Jung. He's a counselor. He got very upset with me once when I said that he was I can't remember the term I used, but before the Skull of the Art came out, he's footnoted in it. And I had put in the footnote his credit that made him sound as though he were a guy with a shingle out and a medical degree or something like that. He said, no, I can't let you say that because you're trying to still to change it. But he's a practitioner, and if he insists, I'll say on a lay level. But he wrote a book called Wetiko, and now he's written a sequel, as it were. Really, it's an enlargement of Wetiko called Dispelling Wetiko. And Wetiko is a Northwestern American Native American word, and it the word translates, or has been said by the Native American tribes who observed Wetiko to be, or to have been, to be the greatest epidemic sickness known to humanity.
We're sorry to cut off Eric Larson, our special guest on the Reynolds Reveal, but we will resume on the other side of the break, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and we here at the Guerrilla Media Network do welcome your calls, especially first-time callers, and the number is 218-862-9829. And my guest today is a wonderful read, and it's great to listen to him as well. And Eric Larson is my guest. He's the author of most recently The Skull of Yorick and two novels, and he is a retired professor of English. Oh, that's tough duty. That's tough duty. Composition, maybe in literature, that would be more enjoyable, I think, to teach. But
I did have the good luck to live the second half of my career in CUNY on the backs of slating adjunct teachers. After a certain point, the university saw fit, as so many universities have seen fit, to disproportionately hire adjunct faculty over full-time faculty. And so as the years went on, for the first 15 or 18 years, I taught my dose of composition, indeed, but with literary courses in between. But for the last 10 or 15 years, I had to teach no compositions, only the literary courses. So
you know, I had a
very, very easy.
Very good. I had a colleague at Texas A&M, an oceanographer, who put this system well. He says it's a system where the old exploit the young. But we have to we have to go back to content and your experience on 9/11 raises this question. The reason I brought up this psychopath at the top is it's maybe the most, arguably, the biggest barrier to get people to face this, because they believe that our leaders are normal. And they that are, so they say, this is impossible. They just reject it out of hand that our government could possibly, in alliance with some others, perhaps like private contractors, do this attack, this murderous, spectacular Hollywood-type attack on Americans.
Now, there's a lot to be said here. First, I'm going to complete my thought on that previous allusion to another book, Paul Levy, a book called Dispelling. Yes, it's called Dispelling Wetiko, and Wetiko is a concept that came from northwestern American Native Americans, and it was. It is the, at what it's billed as, they call it, the greatest epidemic sickness known to humanity. And what it does is explain psychopaths. I'm not going to try to say the word, but the psychopaths, the existence of psychopathology. It's very, very, very similar to Jungian, the concept of the shadow in Jung. And so the conception is that everyone has evil in them, but those who can't embrace, can't rationalize in the good sense of understand rationally and incorporate into the whole self. Those who can't incorporate the shadow or their Wetiko into their whole selves will suffer badly from their Wetiko. And one of the things that they will do and consistently do is cast the Wetiko out, as the Jungian would cast out the shadow, and then have it stick to others, and then look at those others as evil, and justifying their own enemies, therefore. The book is a brilliant, brilliant book. It has a long blurb by Sting. The world would be a better place if everyone read this book. And that has a lovely introduction by the very great Catherine Austin Fitz. And it's I'm hoping to
How do you, Eric, if I could interrupt, how do you spell Wetiko?
Wetiko. It's not an easy book. Yeah, it's not an easy book, but it is an easy book in the sense that it's like reading Where Did the Power Go? People say, I don't understand chemistry. Oh, I can't read the formulas. And I've told them, I don't know how many times, you don't have to understand chemistry or have to understand the formulas. Read them and read Dr. Judy Wood's explanations of them. She's so good. So good.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant teacher.
Yes, a brilliant teacher. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, that's one of the things that people have used against her, too. She doesn't tell them what to think. And she says, of course I don't tell you what to think. That's not learning. That's indoctrinating, which I couldn't agree more with. I've written about that at some length in A Nation Gone Blind. But in any case, Wetiko, psychopathology, sociopath, yes. And what's most remarkable is that not only are they at the top, and you can see them. I mean, you remember the but Paul Levy first wrote the Madness of George W. Bush, a study in I think mass psychopathology. It's a wonderful book, far far better than that more popular book by who about Bush on the couch.
It was Bush on the Couch was the one I read.
Yeah.
I wasn't aware of the Levy book, which you say is superior.
Right. Much, much superior. I had an anecdote about the author of the other book, but I'm not going to give it now.
Oh, come on, Eric.
You sure?
Yeah.
Well, listen, I said, Paul asked him if he would read and read the Madness of George W. Bush and perhaps make it give it a plug, and give him a blurb to use, and that was the end of that. He wouldn't do it.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Now that's a fact.
I was thinking that the Bush on the Couch, I've got it on my shelf somewhere where here was a 2004 book, and Levy's book is 2005, correct?
I believe the first one, yeah. And now the new one is the expanded, fuller version is 2013.
Oh, I've got to read that. And that's Paul Levy, L-E-V-I?
No, it's L-E-V-Y.
Okay, L-E-V-Y.
Yeah, Yeah, I've always called him Paul Levy, and he's never corrected me, so I suspect that's how he goes. But these are remarkable books, just remarkable. And if anybody did read Books on the Couch and would like to read the real thing, I think that's the way to go. The Madness of George W. Bush.
That's the way I've got to go. I'm among the many you're speaking of, I think.
Yeah, I read it after I'd read Paul's book, and I understood the vast difference.
So do we need to fill in a little about your intellectual journey? Because you were, as most of us were, fooled on the day, and then gradually awakened in our own different ways.
Yeah, I tell you, absolutely. The one whom I most admire, of course, is Dr. Judy Wood. She knew from the first glimpse of the disintegration on television that something was fishy. I didn't. I should have. I didn't. I went along limpingly, confusedly, not in looking into anything until June of 2003. And my family, our daughters and my wife and I, were able to get away for a week in June of that year. And I grabbed some of the current Gore Vidal pamphlets that he was putting out at that time. Of course, I should say here now RIP, because so that's a loss of a wonderful thinker and writer. But nevertheless, it may have been my brother-in-law, dear brother-in-law, borrowed them from me, and I haven't seen them since. I'm afraid I won't, but I can replace them. But I think it was probably Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace. It may not have been, but I had a couple of them with me. And for the first time, I became aware that there had been a failure to scramble interfering fighter jets in time to, or in the right place, to intercept the supposedly hijacked, supposed airplanes, airliners. Well, that, I just sat up in my reading chair and thought, my God. I had a friend who had been more and more getting rather increasingly depressed, and I talked with him a lot. We became firmer friends. One morning on the sidewalk in front of our building, he said, well, I just can't believe we don't live in a free country anymore. And I did, I was so stupid. I didn't even know what he was actually referring to. I didn't know the terms or the timing or the Patriot Act. I began paying attention. And this my friend, in fact, though, he became a suicide attempt between that time and 9 months later. He's fine now. And I hope I might have done a little bit of pulling around. But in any case, he had prepared me for suspicion, and Gore Vidal gave me this one simple fact of the non-scrambled interceptors, and I started reading, and I have been reading ever since. I read and read and read what I could get my hands on, and finally, of course, I read Mike Rupert's book, Crossing the Rubicon, and from there on, it's been simply more and more and more and more books.
Sure.
Now, so I became extraordinarily exercised. And I had this this marriage destruction syndrome. I had a tough time. I couldn't shut up. And my wife and daughter said, well, what are we supposed to do? What can we do with this information? And it was a very bad couple of years. Then came 06, and then the publication of Nation Gone Blind. And people said, I must set up a website to help push the book. And I did, and devoted the next 3 years or a little more to putting up pieces on that website, piece after piece after piece after piece, mainly about the what I called, like, took this from, what did you hear? I'm going to be bad at remembering names now, because I have been a little bit onto other subjects in the last several months. But in any case, the so-called left gatekeepers.
The left gatekeepers, which you say is a term you borrowed from Barry Zwicker, Towers of
Barry Zwicker, yep. Yeah. Thank you. Whom I now believe to be one of them.
Okay. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Yes, because there wasn't any critical commentary in that I saw in Skull of Yorick against Zwicker.
Yeah, I wasn't up on that yet at the time. But those pieces I put on my website became the pieces in the Skull of Yorick. And I'd like to do a second book of them, but I'm not sure I will. So that's the story of it for me. But at last, my family life was saved because I had this web writing outlet. I began to write and write and write and write. So that was it for me. And then what happened was, of course, I got, you know, I went through the history, but I did it slowly and as a naive. For example, you know, Scholars for 9/11 Truth, I joined it. But they never did get the secretarial details
right.
in place, so
yeah.
I never became listed as a member.
And then, Eric, you became one of our leading experts on the cover-up and the criticism of this vapid. Let me tell you a story about the primary tactic the establishment writers use, uh-huh. and that is, I spent a year on Capitol Hill in 93-94, yes. and I can remember I worked for Dick Armey, who you may have heard of, the then well-known and semi-powerful Texas congressman, and he's a PhD economist. He used to teach at University of North Texas. But one of the early people I met there were two of his sharp aides. Very gregarious and politically savvy. One of them is Eddie Gillespie, who later on became the chair of the Republican National Committee. Uh-huh. And I didn't even know who these, you know, there were, I was there with Steve Moores, another economist, and these political operators are giving us all this input. But I remember one comment by Eddie was, ridicules the first weapon of, or maybe most powerful weapon of politics. So that keeps on coming up in your various essays where you have the an unpleasant assignment to wade through all the lies of the New York, you know, Amy Goodman and all these horrible Frank Rich and, you know, tell us about that.
Well, yes, absolutely. I began reading the newspaper. With an eye of the new eye, as it were. And I began seeing the degree to which there was, I think, I don't know, but I think maybe that word psychopathic is in order, lying to a degree and at a level that I found inexplicable. I find one of the most awful things was, or one of the best examples, if you will, I suppose, was when Frank Rich put on the cover of the New York Times review of books.
Well, I'm afraid Eric Larson, my special guest today, probably can't wrap up that thought within.
I'll get it back.
So we will have to come back. You will have to come back to learn what Eric Larson's going to say about Frank Rich of the New York Times. This is the Reynolds Reveal. So rejoin us after the break. Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and yes, the Guerrilla Media Network invites calls. 218-862-9829. That number again, 218-862-9829. And my special guest today is Eric Larson, who I first read in the foreword to Dr. Judy Woods' Where Did the Towers Go? Please order that book. It's just, hey, one way to do it is wheredidthetowersgo.com and order that. It's vital. It's Eric Larson and I concur. It's the most important book of the 21st century. Now, and Eric has been on patrol skewering so much of the cover-up artists, and they are cover-up artists, I'm convinced, because they number one, they aren't that dumb, and number two, they've been around, they know what's going on. They've looked up at some of the research on 9/11, and they don't even ask a decent question. They're just flacks for the liars at the top. And Eric, after that little setup, you were discussing Frank Rich of the New York Times.
He became a scourge for me because he was so programmatic, a falsifier, on and the acme of this whole phenomenon occurred on May 27th, 2007. A book by Dom DeLillo had been published called Falling Man, a very poor, third-rate novel about some guy who goes around town, New York City, and pretends to plunge from heights, or from places like train trestles to his death, but then he's saved by something like bungee cords. It's just a very poor book in every single way. But Frank Rich adored it. He put it on the front cover of the Times Book Review, or his keepers put it on the front cover. And what struck me, I wrote it up. It's in a very long, 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 long essay. It concludes the book, The Skull of Yorick, and asks the question whether there can be a literary life in a post-1984 country or nation. The answer is overwhelmingly no. And so I go through a number, Dwight Garner, Rebecca Solnit, Don DeLillo, and, of course, Frank Rich, and look at them as literary people, and they fail. They fail completely, all kinds of literary tests. So in any case, what DeLillo, I wrote in here, I see this, worst of all, though, and the thing one suspects that triggered Frank Rich into jumping and dancing for joy was that DeLillo seems to have swallowed the entire phony story about 9/11, hook, line, and sinker. Not only did he swallow it, but almost like a kid with a new toy, he set out to exploit and celebrate it. Sort of with a wonderful new Made in the USA stamp on it. And I just find this astonishing. I ask, he's had 5.5 years at that time to read about 9/11, think it through. So I ask, how smart are we? How smart are our literary intellectuals? Who do they spend their time talking to? What do they read? And do they read? Then I go into a paragraph, a typical Richian paragraph from this review. And I don't know whether I should read it or not, but I tell you, I'd be happy to if you'd be interested in hearing it. Should I go ahead?
Sure. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Hey, if I start yawning, Eric, I'll intervene. Go ahead.
Okay. All right, good. All right, now, so, and Frank Rich, I ask, his happy, happy dance of praise is positively intolerable. And in fact, I write, don't read this next quote without a basin handy. And so he goes, if Underworld took its cues, that earlier book, of course, of DeLillo's, if Underworld took its cues from the kinetic cinema of Eisenstein, Falling Man, up until its remarkable final sequence, is all oblique silence and enigmatic close-ups reminiscent of the domestic anomie of the new wave. In DeLillo's hands, this is not at all limiting or prosaic. There's a method to the René or René-like fogginess. The cumulative effect is devastating as DeLillo, in exquisite increments, lowers the reader into an inexorable rendezvous with raw terror.
With raw
terror.
Terror. Oh.
Terror. The word. The word.
Yes.
And I say next, two lines, that is a paragraph of such tripe as to offend any normal and moral person if such a person were to pay attention closely to what it says. And I'd be happy to talk more about that paragraph. It does, it epitomizes so much of the quality of what these essays focus on. Again and again and again. Jacob, oh dear, editor of, of Slate. What is his last name? I haven't thought about these.
Weisberg?
Yes. Oh, remarkable, dunderheaded, foolish things that he printed in Slate regarding how, you know, it's just the same kind of thing. Nicholas Lemann, the then dean of the Columbia University School of Journalism, in writing in the New Yorker, absurdities, infantile absurdities regarding 9/11.
Now, don't we need to heap a lot of the culpability for the slow progress in breaking this wide open on such people? Because you made a striking remark early on in the Skull of Yorick collection, which said, you know, the most amazing thing about it, words to this effect, this was the idea, that 9/11, the most amazing thing is the post 9/11. How can people fall for this stuff? that, you know, aluminum planes just slice right through these structural steel columns of the strongest towers in the world. You know, one thing after the other, it's preposterous. And then, you know, people are in denial. It's just, and then they've set up this absurd world enemy, you know, radical Muslim jihad terrorism, because we don't have a worthy enemy, you know. So the whole military and the whole thing is so obviously fake.
Yeah. There's so many threads there that I would like to pull on. One of them is the psychopath one. It has got to be determined, you know, to what degree. For example, I think of I'm so sorry. Tom.
Hey, Eric, you and I are retired, so we're entitled to these moments.
Right? Oh, thank heaven. That's very gracious of you to say, Morgan. Thanks. But Tom's Dispatch.
Engelhart.
Yeah.
Engelhart.
Yeah. Before, or either before 9/11 or immediately after, he published a very nice novel called The Last Days of Publishing. And it was a very intelligent, nicely done novel that I actually reviewed for an outlet and praised to the skies. And he never wrote another word of fiction after that, as far as I know. But he set up Tom Dispatch, under the Nation Institute. And I tell you, I think that they are an organization to be trusted as you would trust adders fanged. He's made a shot. I can't stand it. I mean, the whole nation. Who's the fellow back in 06? He published something called, a lot of people were publishing these awful pieces with the word paranoia in the titles, because it was an anniversary of, was it, of the politics of paranoia? Or I'm trying to think of the historian.
Oh, yeah, the Richard Hofstadter.
Hofstadter,
1959 or so. Yeah, he was commissioned, I understand the facts established, you know, that by he got some government money to write that, as I recall, you know, which would make sense, or at least kind of the neocon equivalent of the day. Commissioned him to do it.
Yeah. And Nicholas Lemann took the bait and wrote in the New Yorker on that subject. And a fellow named Chris Hayes? Could it be? That's the right name. I think it is. Wrote on that same subject and using the same title and vocabulary in the Nation itself. I remember because I went down to the Ethical Culture Society one afternoon to hear people deliver speeches on impeachment of George W. Bush, and among them were the mother whose son was killed in Iraq and who camped outside of Bush's.
What was her name? Cindy. Something.
Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan. And she spoke. Others. I was going to stand up at the mic afterwards and line up and ask a question if you were able to do. I was going to say, why is there no mention of the actual cause or source of the disruption of the World Trade Center in this discussion? But I didn't do it because I saw there was absolutely no point, because they were giving out free issues of the Nation at this event with that, I believe the name is Chris Hayes, article in it. the paranoid style in 9/11 thinking, something that's wrong with it. And it was just one
There are sins of omission and sins of commission.
In there,
and quite often the sins of omission are primary.
And yet, these a piece like this one and a piece like the one that ran in the Progressive magazine, Matthew Rothschild. These are commission because they go on the attack. They don't just omit, but they go on the attack and commit slander.
It's time for another break, Eric.
Keep that thought.
We will. The break. This is the Reynolds Reveal, and I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds. Please rejoin my special guest, Eric Larson, on the other side. Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds. Yes, we do welcome calls here at the Guerrilla Media Network, and the number is 218-862-9829. And we are going to resume our conversation with Eric Larson, retired professor at City University, New York. And he has, a half a dozen books out there. The one that I almost completed reading today is The Skull of Yorick. And Eric is an incredibly articulate, beautiful writer and passionate. Eric, I'm just pleased to see that you have a sense of humor.
Without it, we're doomed.
Yeah. Yes, I agree. Right. Who was it? Oscar Wilde said life is too important to take seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Laughter is has the most acute eye. Yeah.
And I've got to mention, you mentioned Tom Englehart of Tom Dispatch, and they run, my home page is antiwar.com.
Yeah.
Now, they do a useful service, but it's the sin of omission. Anytime Justin Raimondo or any of these guys mention 9/11, they give you the official account. It's just, and I can't spend all my time refuting them via email, which is not really productive. You know, in other words, they're everywhere. I don't care if it's the libertarian right or the old line left. It's at a minimum aggravating. It's angering, isn't it? You mentioned anger. How you get angry at this?
Yeah, absolutely. That's partly why I tried to give The Skull of Yorick a weightiness by its allusion to Hamlet. Hamlet was angry. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it's my favorite Shakespeare play. You know, that's no embarrassment. But I took this notion. I mean, Hamlet is really angry, but at the same time, he sees into the very heart of the heart of things. And he looks into that skull of Yorick, and what does he see? He sees nothingness. Right, but he's able to understand nothingness, and but you know the nothingness of that abyss. What is the point of existence? You know, but for us, the point of existence, I think, is much clearer than it was for Hamlet. No, I don't. I don't think that at all. I think it's the same as it was for Hamlet. We have such a poisoned kingdom, just as his kingdom had been poisoned by the murder of his father. Mm-hmm. Ours has been poisoned right in the very core of its being, and it's dying. It's dying from this poison. It is sick and getting sicker every day. And every apologist, every person like Frank Rich or like Tom Englehart or like Nicholas Lemann or like Amy Goodman or like Any of those who I mentioned.
Well, how about Rachel Maddow? You mean you just look at the left? It's just.
Oh, dear.
It's a wasteland.
It is, but it's so uniform. Now, the question I have is, with that uniformity, let's go back to the question of psychopathology. Who knows what and is deciding not to talk about it or to cover it up and distort it? Take Rachel Maddow. She's very smart. What does she know and what doesn't she know? Now, who is that guy that preceded her, the fellow who sort of preceded her?
Olbermann?
Yeah, Olbermann. Mm-hmm. That's the first time I heard of him and saw some stuff. I don't watch television, but I do watch some stuff on the computer. And I thought, oh, here's a man who can use. He never got close. He's just like Tom Engelhart. He's an opportunist, and he is a hypocrite. These people take a left liberal position, and they will just, all kinds of subject and material comes to them. Military over-expenditure, military atrocities, and all.
Well, an obvious explanation, Eric, that is partially satisfying is a lack of guts. I get aggravated where I say, now this is hyperbole, but hey, if there aren't any Americans left, then the hell with America.
That's going to be the case.
You can't. Well, I don't know. I don't know if I agree with that, but that forecast. But you know, it's like the polls you pointed to in the Skull of Yorick, where hey, you know, 1/3 of Americans at least are willing to tell an interviewer call that yeah, the government was involved with 9/11. You know, I don't buy this crap.
Yeah, you know, by that there are 1/3 of the people are skeptics on 9/11?
Yes.
Or did I misunderstand?
Well, I think you can easily get to the 1/3 that either the government knew, that's such a weak case, but or the government did it, did it to us.
Yeah,
it's a very large, like you said in the book, if you had 300 million plus Americans, there's 100 million.
That's right.
So,
something is going
on.
Hey,
let me ask you as an English professor a sideline question curious about, because you mentioned Shakespeare as all English professors must. And, you know, there's this underworld, if you will, that says Shakespeare didn't do these works.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
And, well, I just wondered if you didn't thought about or investigated that. Is that all just conspiracy theory, quote unquote, unfounded or what?
In my view, it's solid as a rock. For many, many years, most of my life up until about a decade ago, I simply poo-pooed it all myself, and I thought, doesn't matter whether it was Shakespeare of Avon or not. And went on with my reading and teaching and so forth. Then came a book by a guy named Sobran. I can't remember his first name. S-O-B-R-A-N.
Oh, Joseph Sobran. Yeah.
Sobran. He's died since. He was an independent right-wing thinker, commentator,
conservative.
Writer.
Conservative. Yeah, columnist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he wrote a book, and I can't remember the title of it, but the gist is Who Wrote Shakespeare. I read it. It was brilliant. It was fascinating and compelling. And he's an Oxfordian. Which is the first name of the Earl of Oxford, the 14th, I think, Earl of Oxford. Anyhow, so I asked a Shakespeare specialist friend and got into a tussle because he was not any more willing to accept that idea than say, Tom Engelhart would accept Dr. Judy Wood's proofs the type of energy that destroyed the World Trade Center. So another book came along by a guy named Anderson, and I think his first name I can't remember the first name. I might be able to spot it here, but he has a wonderful book that deserves every widest possible reading. And it's not Who Wrote Shakespeare. Oh, and Shakespeare by Another Name. Yeah, a takeoff on the Wherefore Art Thou Romeo? What is a rose by any other name?
Yeah.
It's not foul, but sweet. And so his title is Shakespeare by Another Name. It is another just knockout, brilliant book. But to me, it makes the case, absolutely without any serious question, it makes the case that it was the Earl of Oxford
did the plays for lots and lots of different reasons. Among
now,
them,
of course, at one level, we are blessed to have these works, you know, considered the greatest literature.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's still fascinating to know about this hunt and your concurrence that, it wasn't William Shakespeare, it's the Earl of Oxford.
The works aren't going to go away. But Oxford is a much more reasonable author candidate because, for one thing, Shakespeare never traveled abroad, and Oxford traveled abroad a lot. He traveled as far east as, I don't know whether he got to Istanbul or not, but he spent a whole bunch of time in Italy and then came back and wrote the comedy.
Is a digression I should halt, but it's fascinating, and I wonder, how did this come about or why? You know, what?
The cover-up?
Yeah. Well,
the concept that Anderson has, and I think it's probably plentifully sufficient as an explanation, is that for the nobility, it was a very unacceptable social thing to do, to associate with the theater, let alone be involved directly in the theater. You could go to the theater, certainly so, but to be part of it, to be an actor or to be a writer of the drama, it was very lowbrow. It was an embarrassment that a nobleman's reputation couldn't have survived. So that in order to keep himself in the good graces of Elizabeth and her court, he had to do it somewhat in disguise. Now, Shakespeare of Avon was a good guy. I don't know, he was all right. He was a theater man, and he was present, and he was there. And either with his agreement or without, I don't know, his name was used instead of Oxford's. And I think it's just, none of my friends will admit this with me, except none of my listeners.
But I'll bet they haven't read the two books you've documented here, and the evidence is compelling to you, at least.
Yeah, it's very compelling to me. Yeah. So that's the way I am on that position. On the 9/11, I am so stymied. How can it be so solid a front? From Amy Goodman through Tom Englehart through all the rest, all of them. There's not an exception, is there? There's Morgan Reynolds, there's Dr. Judy Wood, there's Eric Larson. Who else?
Well, let's ask Eric. Something has got to break our way. Edward Snowden, this seems to have awakened revelations about NSA and the spying and the surveillance state and confirmation of the loss of almost all our rights, and this has got to help us. I don't know. It might, though.
It might. What's going to happen? I'm not entirely sure. Certainly not. I'm rather naive, I think, in many of these matters. But let me get a name back into my. Oh, it can't happen here. Who is the author of that website? The wonderful. He's another guy who's either got cold feet or blockage or whatever on 9/11. But it is John Lindhoff. Is that it?
There was one you referenced, Lindin.
Lindin. That's another matter. He writes for the Intrepid Report. I'll get it. But in any case, he has a wonderful piece, a recent one. Why did Edward Snowden go to hide in Hong Kong? And I'm so sorry, walking on these words makes you feel terrible, doesn't it? But I guess at 71 and a half, I can.
Hey, you know, that's part of the fun, and I always liked interviews, whether reading them or listening to them, because our humanity and our stumbling around came out. You know, it's not the polished piece on the printed page or on the computer screen.
Yeah.
It helps our youth, Eric. That used to be said in graduate school when these famous economists would come through the University of Wisconsin, and you too can do what they do. See the way they are? They're just human beings, you know?
Yes, yes. Speaking of graduate school, I'm going to digress a little bit to Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And of course, the name I'm now repressing is the name of the very famous guy who's heading that. That is architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, who I...
Richard Gage.
Gage, yeah. And in a piece that I recently wrote, I wrote a five-part essay called "The Dr. Judy Wood and the Future of the Earth," because I mean, we mustn't let that fact or point fade away or be unaddressed. It's not a matter of 9/11 truth only politically, for example, and in hoping to get some kind of populist control back from our runaway fascist government, but it's also a matter of the future of the Earth, because what Dr. Judy Wood has shown is the presence of free energy and the harnessability of free energy. The fact that, for example, it was stolen from the legacy of Tesla and hoarded by the military apparatus, and only, what is his first name, Hutchison?
Yes, John Hutchison.
John Hutchison had been doing private experimentation and coming up with the same results, levitation, odd, non-heat-producing fires, the breakage of materials from inside themselves, and also above all, one of the major ones is the interpenetration of materials.
Like yeah, wood. Melding. Yeah.
Melding. Yeah. And these all have to do with the trans. What's the word now? I haven't been thinking enough about my Dr. Judy Wood.
Well, it's changes at the molecular level, we could say.
Exactly. Yeah, and the word that she would prefer us to use is trans. No, I see. Anyhow, yes, changes, and not only changes, but sharing at the molecular level.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Now, where was I? I'm glad that you.
Well, you're talking about the future of the Earth.
Yeah, that's right. No, but before that, you mentioned graduate school, and that triggered this. In that five-part piece, when I got to the subject of Richard Gage and did some analysis of things he said and has been and is on record as saying, he's advocating the simple non-observance of available empirical evidence. You know, when this fellow on Abraham Rodriguez, a medical student in the Middle West, this is on videotape and it's absolutely worth watching.
Yes.
It's just very worth watching. Abraham Rodriguez was a contributor to the AE for 9/11 Truth, gave him $100 and signed their petition for a second investigation. And then he emailed Richard Gage and said, listen, I've discovered this new researcher, Dr. Judy Wood, and it's fascinating, some of these things. For example, all of the so-called scorched cars. And he said, I wonder whether you're aware of this and would be willing to think about it or talk to me about it or something of the sort. He never heard back, but what he did find is that he had been dropped from the petition that he'd signed. He'd been excised. He had been removed.
Yes.
He had been made to disappear.
And undesirable.
Yes, and non-desirable, absolutely. You know. So he went and he approached Gage at a speaking engagement and asked him how come that was. But those are what's videotaped. But anyhow, Gage says, well, we don't talk about the scorched cars because they're not part. I mean, he doesn't say it in these words, but very nearly, because they're not part of our thesis.
Yes.
And so my remark in the essay is, in graduate school, that was one of the fastest, quickest, seat of the pants, boot in the seat of the pants way out of grad school that I knew of. So it's just not.
Yeah. I'm only going to look at evidence in a very circumscribed way, if that.
Absolutely. Only if it fits my thesis.
Yeah, somebody made a very demeaning remark that was pretty funny. I can't reproduce it, about what an architect is. It's a guy with some kind of blueprints and an interior decoration bent. You know, in other words, it wasn't really an engineer, you know.
Nope.
Yeah.
Well,
You are listening to The Reynolds Reveal, and my great guest is Eric Larson, a retired English professor who's weighed in very heavily and insightfully on 9/11. So come on back and rejoin us after the break. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Yes, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? It's all I ever have.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. I don't care how much money I gotta spend. Got to get back to my baby again. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. When she wrote me a letter, said she couldn't.
Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and if you would like to call in, we do welcome calls at the Guerrilla Media Network number 218-862-9829. My special guest today, Eric Larson from New York City, a novelist, a great analyst of the fallout from 9/11 and the cover-up. And we do have a call, Jeff in New York on line one. Jeff, welcome to the Reynolds Reveal.
Oh, great. Hey, great show. And I'm a big fan of Professor Larson's work. The Skull of Uruk is just a fantastic book. And I wanted to ask you guys, you touched on it for a minute, about WikiLeaks and Snowden. And is there any, has there been any material that's come out in support of Dr. Wood's work, or maybe geoengineering, the aerosol operations? You would think that those critical areas that are covered up would have, you know, that's what WikiLeaks and, you know, this kind of thing is about, to expose these, you know, these specific kinds of areas of secrecy that these people are, you know, chronically lying about. And just if you could... Professor Larson, can I get your opinion on people like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert?
Oh, man. Well, Morgan, you want to start?
No, Eric, you're the guest on the spot.
Okay. Well, I think that Stewart and Colbert, I don't watch them, but I've seen them, and I know about them. And I think that they're limited hangout guys, too. I think they're in exactly the same camp and category as Tom Engelhardt. By the way, the name of the guy that I do admire, Dave Lindorf, that's the name I was failing to pull up. But he too, he won't do it. He won't go the entire route, though he's a handsome writer. Wonderful recent piece that I think I mentioned on Edward Snowden, why he went to Hong Kong. But I think that's what they are. I hate saying it, but did I love writing The Skull of Uruk? No. And did I love finding no exceptions to the progressive left liberal barricade against the truth about 9/11, let alone the truth about Dr. Judy Wood's groups of the use of free energy technology? No, it hasn't made me happy. I want exceptions, but I can't find them. I just can't find them. As far as WikiLeaks, you know, the Bradley Manning, and now the Edward Snowden cases, I have nothing but admiration for what they're doing.
Right.
I pray to God that Bradley Manning can somehow get legal treatment of a type that would befit his enormous contribution. And the same thing for Edward Snowden. But I don't think either one of them has a clue about these materials, these matters, or about Dr. Judy Wood's book. I doubt it.
Right.
Where would a guy in the service, in Bradley Manning's case, for example, where would he have been exposed to it? That's a guess, but it's a fearful one on my part. I think that probably is the case. What do you think, Morgan?
Well, they have access to the internet, although I saw the item the other day about certain sites and news items are banned that involve, you know, the ongoing scandals and meltdown of the Obama administration. But here in response to Jeff, I think Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong, was looking for some kind of a confirmation of Dr. Wood's book in the works, the leaks, the geoengineering. Is that right?
No, specifically, you know, Dr. Wood's material, I mean, she, as Professor Larson pointed out, presented irrefutable evidence in her book, Where Did the Towers Go? And it's such, and as you guys both pointed out, everyone must have this book. And Professor Larson said it's one of the most important books of this time. It's absolutely true. This book is, I mean, is the real deal. And it shows irrefutable evidence on how the towers came apart in the air and so on. And then evidence of directed free energy technology. We know that that technology, the directed free energy technology, it's a weapon, and it's in the wrong hands right now. And that's something that it's painful, but everyone's got to accept it and come to realize that that's
Jeff,
going on.
You have to listen in next week. She's my guest on the Reynolds
good.
Reveal.
Wonderful.
Okay.
Very good. So, Jeff, you're not. I mean, her book and the evidence is irrefutable. We don't need confirmation from anybody in the engineering or the priesthood or anywhere. You know,
you're right.
And my problem with engineers and scientists is they are even more bought up in this hierarchical top-down system than most professions. So you can't expect much support for the truth on such something that's so sensitive.
You're right about that, and Dr. Wood has also experienced that with being ignored in the architects and engineers for 9/11 and all of that. But, you know, I just want to thank you guys for doing a great job. And Professor Larson, thanks for exposing these, you know, these milquetoast liars out there in the progressive media. I really appreciate that.
Well, I thank you. It's good to hear that from you. And
thanks, Jeff, for your call. Listen in next week.
Will do.
Yeah. And, Eric,
yes.
You have a very good feel for the pulse of America, not just what's going on in the literati. And I mean, one observation I have is that the corporate media is committing suicide on the slow. Young people know that that's not where you can get the truth. If the truth is known, you just got to look on the internet, and the hell with the corporate media. I mean, the young people don't read newspaper. I get a newspaper every day.
Yeah.
You know, this, I always loved newspapers from the time I delivered them as a kid. So, we're going to pass, and it's going to be much more difficult to mind control the younger people, don't you think?
Oh, I think it's going to be just terrible, just terrible. I fear for my granddaughter. I fear for my own daughters. The degree of intrusion into the private lives of people is what I think I'm probably most terrified by. I wrote A Nation Gone Blind in 06. I think it's been mentioned, and plentifully so. But one of the central thesis of it is that the blindness has been created. I take 1947 as a starting point of the development of the true mass media and the true conditioning arts of the mass media. I come to the conclusion that, and you can see this in writers. I mean, it's an analysis of writing writers as much as anything. And in writers, there was a time when a writer would write because a writer saw something or felt something that could not be written by, about. In other words, one was driven by a personal feeling or a sensation or a location or a surrounding or an atmosphere or an event that simply compelled a person. Hemingway's stories are about this from stop to go. Every good short story in the whole great long history of the short story, good novels as well, are from that core origin, that little homely, personal, private experience. Nowadays, what do you get? all of academia has been turned right upside down and emptied out, because what happened was, with political correctness and the rise of it and the aftermath of the end of the Vietnam War, what happened is that thought, feeling, passion, sensation on an individual, simple, isolated in yourself level has disappeared. It's been replaced with what? Race, class, gender, and ethnic identity. And everything starts with race, class, gender, or ethnic identity, and then comes the writing, or then comes the thinking. Junot Diaz, people speak of him as the new Faulkner. Well, I've heard him speak. I've read some stuff that he's written. I haven't read his books, but I'm not very excited about it. Seems to me that what happened is that race, class, gender, or ethnic identity came first, and Junot Diaz felt that came after. Now, I know I'm setting myself up for a big fall if it turns out that Junot Diaz is really good. The evidence that I've read, it seems, isn't there, but I'll read them and find out. But I've read a lot of other writers and tried to find out. The Skull of York takes up something that went out, I think, in 03. I'm not entirely sure. The State Department approached 15 or 18, or maybe 20, I can't remember, authors, American writers, and asked them to produce essays on the subject of what it means to be an American writer. Well, when I heard about that, I read it in the New York Times, I thought, oh my God, do I want to read that? Turned out that it was not available in the U.S., but only available abroad. I can't remember the name of the law that caused that to be the case. It's a huge story. It's in the book. But I did get hold of it online, and I printed it off, and I read it once, and I thought, well, being, you're supposed to read it again and see whether your first response was accurate. So I read the whole book again, and I graded each piece. And the grades that these pieces received are in A Nation Gone Blind, and those grades were horrible. There were two A's, a multitude of C minuses, D pluses, and Fs. And these are by well-known Robert Olin Butler, for example. Other names, let's see, Sven Burkert, one of the most abominable pieces in the entire collection. They were awful. And these people couldn't write for a tinker's dam. They didn't know what to say. They didn't know how to say it. They had nothing to say. All they could do was maunder around gropingly, as blind people would, having been given, for example, four little pieces to hold in their hands and write about race, class, gender, and ethnic identity. They were incapacitated.
Yeah, this is maybe a little off topic, but when I found out you were a professor of English, and here I'll just assume you're male and white, today, those would disqualify you, at least put you way back in the queue to be hired in many English departments or comparative literature and the humanities generally, right? Because there's a need diversification by what color you and what sexual preference and all that. Well, when the truth, it doesn't matter, when skills and analytics, et cetera, don't matter, but rather these some are non-controllable. Yeah, all these what to me are irrelevancies, you know. It's an intellectual ruin.
Can I read you something?
Yes.
I wrote this little book on Homer, on the Iliad. It's it's part of a book, a series I want to write of great books for everybody, for regular people, based on my teaching over those 35, 40 years. And in 08, I got a letter, an email from a guy. Here it is. Prof. Larson, I have wanted to say this to you for about the past 10 years. Your obsession in making sure that my mind opened to a world that I never knew existed has helped me tremendously. I could not write, had no interest in literature, and had a hard time enunciating words. I had a very hard time articulating a thought in words, and I didn't have a vocabulary. I felt like an idiot. I grew up in the inner city and attended inner city schools. Stereotypical Latino household, a stereotypical inner city neighborhood in many regards. But it was a white guy from Minnesota who taught me how to read with an analytical skill that helped me beat the stereotype and taught me that I didn't have to be that way. I live today with many of the teachings that were learned as a result of the readings in your classroom. I live with humility, awareness, vocabulary, and understanding. I could go on, but this is an email, not a dissertation. Thank you. God bless. And if it means anything to you, you made a difference in my life, and I thank you for igniting my stale mind. So
isn't that beautiful? That's so warming.
That's
yeah.
Just wonderful. But I like that. But it was a white guy from Minnesota. That really
yeah.
Warm.
That's yeah.
Wonderful. That gives the lie to the whole pre-categorization of thought. You know, an additional part of that story? I looked this fellow up. It was a long time back. I can't now remember whether he was in the course that starts with Homer or the course that starts with Dante. But he failed it. And so what I've written, I cite this letter in the introduction to my series, the literary series. And so I conclude by saying, well, he may have failed the course, but the course didn't fail him. Thank God.
Yes, and Professor Larson didn't fail him.
Well, I'm glad.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's very hope-giving. And a fellow like that, how can he be hoodwinked? How can we justify people doing this to people? I mean, here we go.
Yeah. Here we go, transiting to the break. You are listening to The Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds. My guest today, Eric Larson, who's a beautiful writer and compelling on 9/11 and all the left gatekeepers. So come on back, join us, rejoin us for our last segment next.
To make me blue with some other guy you knew before.
Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I am your host, Morgan Reynolds. And the number to call, should you like to speak with our special guest, Eric Larson, is 218-862-9829. We're in our last segment, Professor Larson. And one of the main themes, the way I'd put it, of your work is we've got a hollowing out of, if not the complete disappearance of the soul of America. And it's a refusal to confront 9/11. It's a cover up of 9/11. So listeners must say to themselves, some of them, what can we do about it? Of course, we can continue to research and write about it and talk about it and try and spread the word, but what kind of a real solution do we need one? I think we need one, right? That's the upshot of your work. You can't go on this way, lying to yourself and lying to others.
I couldn't agree more. the lying is everywhere. Omnipresent. It comes from all of the what should be the sources of the whole truth. Our sources of partial truth or mistruth. My eye is on something by Tom Englehart from May 23rd of this year, and he's taken up the subject of the terror side and the terrorists as opposed to terrorists. These are the people who are laying waste to the earth itself. And of course, there you are. I mean, this is limited hangout stuff, I think, in my view, because what he's going to do is attack an obvious enemy. But he's not going to turn to the means by which that obvious enemy could truly be attacked. For example, by exposing the actuality of 9/11, the availability of the alternative form of energy known as free energy, and by being put in a position through reading of Dr. Judy Wood's book and the evidence it provides, being in this position whereby there could be actual litigation and suits brought forth as to the questions that remain. Now that we know what has happened at the World Trade Center, we can begin to ask who done it, but not before. But, so he writes this while he's going to attack the terrorists, that is T-E-R-R-A, and he says this: the truth is, whatever we call them, it's time to talk bluntly about the terrorists of our world. Yes, I know, 9/11 was horrific. Almost 3,000 dead, massive towers down, apocalyptic scenes. And yes, when it comes to terror attacks, the Boston Marathon bombings weren't pretty either. But in both cases, those who committed the acts paid for or will pay for their crimes. In the margin, I have a big word, nope.
Right.
He doesn't have a clue, or he's not willing to tell. He's either lying or he's ignorant. Now, my point about all of these journalists is, if they are really ignorant, like Frank Rich on down, if they're ignorant of the actualities of 9/11, then why are they journalists? Why are they journalists of stature? They should be let go because they're inadequately prepared in their field of responsibility. And here, either he's inadequate as a researcher, or he's a bald-faced liar. Now, which is
right, right, right. Kind of the premise of your first part was wrong. They're there to control the mass mind. That's why they're getting the big bucks.
That's
right. They're artful liars. Absolute. And how they live with themselves, I don't know. We got the psychopath explanation. They don't have a moral compass.
This goes back to your very first thing on the show tonight about the psychopath. Are they psychopathic? Or are they plain regular criminals who know what they're doing and aren't psychopaths? Either way, whatever. This is dreadful. We're in a serious, serious situation. That kid who wrote that letter, how can an institution that's supposed to have to do with the news, with education, with truth, education itself, how can they let those people go? How can they poison them further and not care for them? I sometimes believe, though I've written books that do nothing but excoriate the masses for being so stupid and so manipulable and for having been turned so passive and for having been made unable to think beyond the level of the purely voluptuary, chop, chop until you drop. I've been terribly harsh on the people. But when
I'm reminded of a couple things by your remarks. One was Gerard Holmgren, the famous Australian no-planer, who's brilliant, argued that understanding 9/11 is inversely correlated with schooling. You know, the more schooling you get, the dumber you are. And I remember doing a couple of interviews on 9/11 pretty early, and they mean in 2005-ish or 6, and in a couple of inner city African American radio stations, and the callers were all about how the real a-holes Cheney and Bush did it. It's kind of the man. Come on, who believes this stuff? So if you will, the least schooled are often the sharpest.
What is the great critic of education, Gatto? What's his first name?
The former teacher in the New York State
system. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's the one that's dumbing down, is his phrase from the beginning. In one of his earliest books, has that in the title.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, it's conditioning. School for him is a matter of conditioning and diminishing rather than enlivening and awakening. And to his great.
Of course, we can both go back to our experiences in higher education in large multiversities, mine at Texas A&M, but the whole thing is a money machine. You pointed out, hey, there aren't any university or college presidents who are intellectuals anymore.
Not
so
anymore.
They're, they're corporate bureaucrats, and the whole deal is to have it's numbers driven, and maximizing the top line is what's going. And if anything good happens below, it's almost accidental. And certainly a professor like me, who I was retired, Robert Gates, the CIA careerist and the former DOD. When I did that article in June of 2005, and it jumped my normal channels, and it says former Bush insider says 9/11 false flag. Well, yeah, the university put out a statement which was not all that objectionable, predictable, about how Professor Reynolds doesn't speak for Texas A&M University, blah, blah, you know, safe bureaucratic ease. But Gates put out this statement that said anyone who suggests that the United States government was complicit in 9/11 is beyond the pale.
Yeah.
And you know what that means. And I'm way out there without any defense or right to live within the walls of civilization.
Exactly.
So here, I mean, why is this guy a university president? It's just an outrage, you know. It just shows what universities, how worthless they are. You know, you want to know about something, you can go on the internet or go down to Joe's Garage or wherever it is. And this whole system is just left over from medieval times, as far as I can see.
Go down to Joe's Garage and hope that you can bump into somebody like Jeff, who called from New York, right?
Yeah.
And as opposed to bumping into a bunch of guys who are, you know, skinheads, you know, be happy to eliminate you as to listen to you. I don't know.
Well, you're in a different environment. I'm not here in Arkansas. People are pretty nice. We still got that rural influence.
My best friend who I've been in touch with since 06 when The Nation Gone Blind came out is a resident of Arkansas, and I hear a lot about it. It's a very interesting thing. But, you know, I think that I don't know how much time we have left, but as far as I can see, what that metaphor of poisoning is crucial to my way of understanding this entire situation. I don't know where fascism comes from. I think it does come from the psychopathic top, no question. It comes from the corporate desire to make everything smooth, to make things simplified. That's the term I used in A Nation Gone Blind. America in an age of simplification and deceit. So there's a double charge. One is that society, feelings, emotions, culture, the whole thing, like I said about emotion and writing, the impulse to become a creative writer, it used to come from the inside. Now it comes from race, class, gender, or ethnic identity, a simplification, a categorization, a limiting of the options that there are to a human heart to feel or a human eye to see. You see what you're all predetermined to see. That's a big theory. The thesis in Nation Gone Blind, that the Americans no longer see reality of and for themselves, determining what it is by what they look at, but they see it in a prepackaged way. They see things as they've been prepared for them by the mass media. You see this more and more in gesture. You hear it in speech. You see it in clothing.
But more and more Americans are willing, a la the Matrix movie, take the red pill. I think that's the reality pill.
And the one thing.
What about impeachment in the Congress? Is that a vehicle that could be used ultimately?
I think there may be 1.5 honest Congress creatures left.
Well, that's kind of short of a majority.
I wish. I don't know.
Professor Eric Larson of City University, New York, retired author, novelist, and brilliant writer. You've got to read him. And he has books available, including the one I mostly read today, The Skull of Yorick. But obviously, we've got The Nation Gone Blind and other works by Eric Larson. So Google him at LARSEN. Thank you so much, Eric, for coming on the Reynolds Reveal.
I'm most appreciative and grateful and flattered. Thank you so much.